This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
In New York City, as the race for mayor comes to a close, one of the proposals gaining momentum by frontrunner Zoran Mamdani is government-owned grocery stores. So he says that without grocery stores having to pay rent or taxes, it will reduce the overheads, it'll pass on the savings to shoppers, it means they can buy and sell at wholesale prices, centralise warehousing and distribution, and on top of that, partner with local neighbourhoods on products and sourcing. That all sounds pretty good in theory. And it turns out around the world there's actually a long history with government-run food outlets, even government-run restaurants in the UK. So could something like that work here? In just a moment, Dave McNamara from Food Bank Victoria will be joining you. We'll get his view on this concept as well as the latest hunger report and whether or not the two somehow are connected. And also this hour, if you have a teenager in your house, would they read a magazine, like an actual magazine? Teen Vogue has just called final days on being a standalone mag, and yet we still mourn the loss and the role of Dolly magazine. So with social media ban just around the corner, could there be a place again for teen magazines?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
What if governments ran supermarkets? Would that reduce our choice, or would it simply reduce prices? Fred Harrison, the CEO of IGA Richie, spoke with Raf earlier this morning about the supermarket wars and how they impact us during a cost of living crisis.
So as competitive as I have seen it in many a year, and it's not just Coles Woolies, everyone's involved, Aldi, Costco, even your local greengrocers, Richie's, IGA, the whole network is really fighting on price at the moment. The consumers made it clear. We are aware more than ever that customers are now shopping multiple shops a week. Say 4 years ago, Raf, people would just do their shopping at one, maybe two stores. Now we're seeing consumers shopping four or five, even six different locations to try and pick up specials.
So what if we stopped the wars, deleted competition? Would consumers win, or would we just be starved of choice? So in New York City, the mayor frontrunner at the moment is actually calling for government-owned grocery stores. Could something like that work here? Would you like to see food for people and not for profit? This really government-run supermarkets, I've seen that in Russia. It doesn't work. Don't go there. Dave McNamara, the CEO of Food Bank Victoria. Dave, you've just released this year's hunger report, and we'll go through all of those details in just a moment because it's really startling. It found that a third of Australians are experiencing food insecurity. Does that come down to cost and the role of supermarkets?
I think in a way it does. I mean, food is all about the cost and the access. And at the moment, too many families are looking at their bills, looking at their finances and deciding, can they feed themselves this week? What do they have to give up? What do they have to pay to make sure that they can put food on the table? And there's more and more people now slipping into the situation where doing everything that they can, they still can't feed themselves. And they're going without meals multiple times per week.
Is that simply because supermarkets now, the duopoly, the supermarket wars, is food too expensive or too hard to access? And are they connected?
I think cost of food is an inhibitor for people, and that's why they are doing multiple shops, because the luxury of the old days where you could just go and do one shop, now you're really looking to make sure that you're not wasting any of the money that you're spending on food and that all that food is getting utilised before you go and shop again. So people are much more cognizant of the food that they're buying, the cost of that food, how long it will last, and the meals that they're going to make with the food that they're buying.
I found it incredible to think about the idea of a government running a supermarket. There is a serious growing appetite in New York City at the moment for government-run grocery stores. It wouldn't be all of them, but for a number of them. Is that just a crazy concept?
It will be an interesting exercise. I mean, there's a lot of infrastructure that they have to put in place. As they said, you need centralised warehousing to make it efficient and effective. You've got to have a purchasing team. They've got to then start competing with the major retailers in the states and getting into those contract negotiations and sourcing food. And as said, they're looking at neighbourhood-specific purchasing, which means that you're going to bring in all the cultural diversity, which will make it a lot more complex as well when they go into purchasing. And the supermarkets have been doing this for a long time. So now they're using AI as well, which gives them, you know, that advantage against each other to purchase the food that they see their customers want. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that price of food drop.
Is it possible to even change the system? I remember years ago doing a conversation hour on if you wanted to avoid the big supermarkets, could you? Right, even because you can't say, well, shop at farmers markets because they might be the third Saturday of every month on occasionally. Is it possible to change the system and to reduce those overheads to ensure that the farmers get a better deal, to reduce the waste and to reduce the cost, or is it too far gone now?
It's always possible to change the system. I mean, that's the hope that we live with because the system isn't working for us. So I think it's a case of looking at where you can insert yourself into the system to start to make those changes. And if you look at food, so the whole food system, in terms of just donations to organisations like us, there's 7.6 billion tonnes of food going to waste every year across Australia that's perfectly edible. The taxation system makes it really difficult for businesses to donate that food because it takes effort to donate. And at the moment, they can just write it off as a business expense. So that's easy. So you've got a lot of food that doesn't make it to market. And like our role is to try and intercept that food where we can and fix the gap in the logistics piece to make sure that we can get that food and get it through to our supply chain, which is through
and
the
that's something that Food Bank's calling for in the Hunger Report is to change that. You've been calling that for a long time, though, haven't you?
Yeah, for years.
Do you feel like you're being heard?
I hope so. Well, hopefully we're being heard today.
But do you think the change will happen?
You're always optimistic and hopeful. I mean, the tax system is a big unwieldy beast and they seem to be there's a system in itself. There's a system that needs addressing. So if the government's serious about making sure there are reforms in that tax system and make it more fair and equitable for all of us Australians, then you would hope that this would be a piece that they'd consider and look at implementing. Because as you said, food is a basic right.
It is a basic right, and it's a right that a lot of people now, one-third Australians, as it turns out in your latest Hunger Report, have some type of food insecurity. This text, are you actually joking? This is insane. You want the government to control our food? Never. And others saying government supermarkets are a great idea. We actually need the government to step in and to protect us against billionaires and big business. We can't leave social welfare up to billionaires. They've shown us that they actually don't care. If it's not the government that's running a supermarket like the proposal in New York City, whether or not that gets off the ground, who knows? Locals and locals owning and running their supermarket. We've seen cooperatives and we've seen town people come together before and save everything from pubs to general stores.
Yep.
Is that something that you've witnessed overseas where the supermarket or the grocery store is actually owned and run by locals?
Yeah, I've seen a number of them. I've seen them in the States. I've just had a holiday in Europe and I saw them there as well. There's lots of different models. There are membership-based models. There are models where you contribute your time as a volunteer each month and you guarantee that and then you get access to shopping. But again, it comes down to the range of food available and that comes down to access to that food. And again, the major retailers and the second tier, you've got businesses that didn't used to sell food that are now selling food. So that's more competition in the sector, but that makes it harder for these social-driven supermarkets and cooperatives to be able to provide to their customers that full range of food that they're looking to.
In the Hunger Report that's just been released, one of the areas that you highlighted was our regional and rural areas. The irony of where the majority of our food comes from are the people who can least afford to buy it. What did it show you?
Well, we just have to go out into the regions and meet the people that are accessing the food that we're providing out there. And it's quite clear that whether you're remote or regional, in a major centre or a small town, the cost of food is higher. It's the transport costs, it's infrastructure related, and so it's really difficult for regional people to get access to the range of food at a cost that's affordable. I mean, most people would say the food's not affordable here in big metropolitan cities. And the food system is all structured to bring all the food into one point so that you've got a broader range that then all the markets can draw back down on.
Christmas is just around the corner. I don't know where this year has gone. I don't even want to think of Christmas decorations are up. They are out and about. It's a stressful time for a lot of families. It's probably one of the busiest times for organisations like Food Bank. Food insecurity and Christmas, how can people get through this period?
This is one of the toughest times of the year because Christmas is a time that all families want to celebrate with their children to make sure that, as far as they know, everything is fine. They're just like every other kid out there. So families are short-term loaning, they're payday lending, they're doing whatever they can to make sure that they can put presents under the tree, have the food for the Christmas dinner, and that will come back later in around back-to-school time. And then we see the repetition throughout the year. So right now is a great time that if you do need help, to reach out for it. There are many charities out there. That's what they do and that's what they want to do. They just want to help people. But now when you looked at that data, I think, you know, we've got households on 91,000 a year, which, you know, we call the middle class, reaching out for assistance for the first time. And it takes missing a lot of meals before people will reach out for help. The quicker that you reach out for help, the quicker you can get it and avoid dropping down into this situation where you can't get out.
It's such an important report, and this is this year's 2025 Hunger Report. What do you want done, just finally? What do you want done with this report, Dave?
I would hope as many people as possible can read it. I hope as many politicians as possible can read it and really understand that, you know, this is not the society I think that any of us want, an Australia where 3.5 million households around the country are going hungry. They're either going hungry completely, missing meals most days, or they're so stressed about trying to make their budgets meet that food becomes a thing that they might have to give up.
Dave, thank you so much for your work, and we wish you and your team all the best into this Christmas period.
Thanks, Rochelle.
David McNamara, the CEO of Food Bank Victoria. Food Bank's 2025 Hunger Report has just been released. It's found that a third of Australians are experiencing some type of food insecurity. Still coming up a little later, teen magazines, could they make a comeback? Is it the perfect time to bring teenage magazines back? We've got the social media ban just around the corner. So what if we brought back magazines?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, my name's Rochelle. We're going to talk teen magazines in just a moment and also Race Around the World. That's being relaunched, so we're going to be looking at reality TV. But lots of different opinions on whether or not you would like to see cooperatives or government run our supermarkets. It's up for serious consideration in New York City. Gary Mortimer is a Professor of Marketing and Consumer Behaviour at the Queensland University of Technology. Gary, people are very divided. Either yes, it's a great idea, or no, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard of. Government-run supermarkets, it's what they're pushing in New York at the moment. Could they work?
No, is the simple answer. And it's a very, very, while it's a novel idea, it's a very, very complex idea, which I think probably hasn't been thought through completely from certainly from a, you know, a macro environmental, economic and competitive situation. So if it's government owned, ultimately you and I are going to have to pay for it some ways, probably through our income tax. So here in Australia, if the incumbent Labor government decides next week. They're going to open 400 government-owned supermarkets and hold prices down to enable struggling families to access those products. It would have to be funded from somewhere. So either income tax would go up to fund these businesses, including buying teams, head offices, leasing, stores, fit-out, staff management and product, or they'd have to move funds from, say, unemployment benefits, NDIS, Social Security pensions to fund these operations. So the costs would be challenging to start with.
Can you change the system, though, so maybe more locally owned and run supermarkets or cooperatives? Is it possible to break, I mean, we have a duopoly, but we have more than two supermarkets, but the supermarket wars, as they've been labelled, is it possible to even break that now?
Well, I think the challenge we've got here in Australia is we've got a very small population, about 29 million people. We're kind of stuck on the eastern seaboard, a little bit over in Perth. So we've got a lot of land mass and very small population, which means we're servicing a small market. Your previous caller talked about other sort of businesses that are selling food and groceries. So it is becoming competitive in the fact we've got sort of two big supermarkets. We've got Aldi now, which has been here about 24 years. They've got about 650 stores and generate about $13.5 billion in sales. We've got Metcash, IGA and Foodland groups in South Australia. We've got Harris Farm. Then, of course, you've got the likes of Reject Shop, soon to be called Dollarama, selling, you know, dry groceries. We've got an online player like Amazon selling around 30% of dry groceries as well.
Because lots of people are actually buying their groceries from places like Amazon now. So the days of, and as we heard Fred Harrison on Raf's show this morning, you know, the days of just being supermarket loyal and having one supermarket that you go to are gone. And sometimes that is taken out of your hands, that it's out of necessity that you need to shop around, buy in bulk, buy online, buy those products wherever they are cheapest. So doing all of that work beforehand.
Yeah, and I guess the nature of grocery shopping doesn't lend itself to shopping around. So we say it's easy to say to shop around. That's great if you live in an inner city suburb or a major suburb where you've got two or three or even four choices of supermarket, or you're willing to go to the end of buying your groceries, you know, online, popping into Costco, dropping into Aldi, going to Coles. A little bit more challenging if you're in the regional centres where you don't have that choice, or like food and grocery shopping, I tend to shop at the same supermarket purely out of habit and necessity rather than bothering to shop around a couple of different brands. So time can also impact on that.
And depending how much time you have, lots of opinion on this. I love that alternative supermarket economics ideas are even being considered. If AI keeps progressing, it will create a much wider gap between the have and the have-nots. Therefore, we do need not-for-profit driven paths to be able to provide food and security to many people who will be affected in the future, says this particular text. Gary, good to get your thoughts on this. I can't imagine anything changing here anytime soon, but it's an interesting concept to at least consider.
Absolutely. Thank you. Cheers.
See, I'm Gary Mortimer, Professor of Marketing and Consumer Behaviour at Queensland University. Others talking about cooperatives not being government-owned. They work perfectly well in the UK and Europe, and the government could support this type of change with laws and other settings. They don't work everywhere, but in some communities you could make them work. That's from Lynn. Up next, would you go on reality TV? Would you even consider going on a reality TV show? Have you auditioned for one? You may have heard this morning the revival of what's been labelled the groundbreaking filmmaking competition series Race Around the World is looking for its new contestants. So would you go on it? When it first dropped about 30 years ago, it was the first reality TV. So what would the next series look like? Let me take you back to Series 2, where Tony Wilson was the winner of Race Around the World 2 back in 1998.
Waltzing Matilda, you'll come waltzing Matilda with me.
San Pedro is a men's prison built just over 100 years ago in central La Paz. It has over 1,000 inmates, twice as many as it was originally designed to hold. I visited the jail to speak to Roberto Hazar, convicted drug dealer and father of three.
Bueno,
Tony Wilson, winner of Series 2 of Race Around the World back in 1998. It feels like only yesterday, my friend. Now author, documentary maker. Tony, could it and will it be the same? 30 years on, Race Around the World was the first kind of reality TV show. Since then, you can't swing a cat without hitting a reality TV star. How will they do it, do you think?
Well, Rochelle, thanks for having me on. What an exciting day. I'm just absolutely over the moon for the new generation of applicants. It's going to be amazing fun. It'll be a little bit different, I imagine. They're saying they're going to try to keep it very similar, and I hope they stick to the sort of the things that I thought made it great were that it was a solo trip, which was incredibly testing. So we filmed all our own pieces, and we were the audio recorder and the producer, and we were everything, and the editor sending paper edits. And that sort of added a loneliness and a difficulty that I think they should maintain. But certainly it'll change in a technological sense. We were sending back paper edits where we were referring to the time codes on our three tapes, mini digi tapes, and then we'd send them back in a bag, in a DHL bag. I mean, nowadays I'm sure the ask will be that people edit themselves to some degree, whether they do a polished
and upload it themselves. It's interesting, yeah. Tony, the love and the affection for it is still so strong and great, and people have such great memories of it and what it did for television, what it did for filmmakers like yourself. I just wonder, given that so much has changed over the 30 years, like you mentioned, you know, you're not going to be sending back, you know, VHS, DHS tapes. You're going to be uploading and doing it all yourself. People have their own YouTube channels, social media channels to make content. Do they need a platform like this, like you did back then?
I think they do. Like, it'll be amazing. It's such a thing. Like, it's a real chance to jump out, you know, like, and even now, even though there's other chances to jump out and YouTube does a job, this will actually give a national platform to make someone who hopefully has a bit of talent. Like, that's what I always, you're talking about reality TV and how they proliferated. Well, I always thought that what our show had was that it really required some storytelling and some vision and some skills that were beyond just sort of existing in a house and getting drunk or whatever. And, you know, so a lot of us went on to have media careers and lives in storytelling. And I think that's because it did ask those things and was a sort of a bit of a meritocracy of sorts, you know. And so, you know, if I was 20 or 18, I think it's over 18, is allowed to apply. Ours was over 20. I'd be just busting for this.
I know. Looking back on it and watching it, it doesn't feel like it was 30 years ago. 1-300-222-774, whether you even consider throwing your hand up to be on the next instalment of Race Around the World, because they are calling for the next big filmmakers and content creators and storytellers. You can apply now, 1-300-222-774, if you would consider it. Tony Wilson is with you, winner of Series 2. Tony, your daughter was pretty impressed, I believe, that she didn't believe you that you were on it. Did you win some kind of cool factor? And how did you manage to go through so long with your daughter not knowing that you were on this show?
they're never really busting to watch the old VHSs. And I believe it or not, even though it seems like I talk about it all the time, I don't talk about it that much. And so, yeah, I did show them a story or two. I don't think they got through all of them, but it was It was fun to tell them, and it is that sort of moment that transformed my life. And again, you know, I'm pitching here to the people who I want to enter. There was a moment I went from being a pretty unhappy lawyer who was obsessing over this application. I thought it was a way out. I could get on this show and I'd get out of my unhappy legal life. And then there was a day where I arrived in La Paz, you know, and that airport's at 3,000 or 4,000 metres or some ridiculous height. And came into this moonscape in the morning at 6 a.m. and just thought, wow, I've got to find a story in the next 10 days. I'm going to be on TV, national TV. It really did feel like my life had changed overnight, you know, within this sort of application period. And these months were desperate for me, like finding my story to apply with and writing the written application. And I treated it like I was going to get on, and I ended up that I did.
I wonder whether it will have the same impact for the next round of hopefuls, for those next round of contestants, so to speak, or of filmmakers. I wonder, given how much the world has changed, Tony Wilson, whether or not it will have the same impact. I hope so.
Well, it's going to be interesting because the one thing they worried about, I think the reason I'm the carryover champion, and they might make me hand in my trophy, it's pretty worrying. But the reason that I think they delayed and didn't do the series again, or they stepped it back to Race Around Oz for 1 year, was that there was actual fear, more fear about people getting hurt and bad things happening to young people than the cost of the show. So everyone said, oh, was it too expensive? I don't think it was ever too expensive. God, they gave us $100 a day. It was pretty cheap TV, I reckon.
But don't spend it all at once.
Yeah, but what they were worried about was, you know, people making bad decisions or just trying to tell a dangerous story. I mean, John Theorist did a thing on homosexuality in Cuba, you know, and the Cuban government really hassled him about that. And, you know, I had my tapes confiscated in Shanghai. There was, you know, and there's just the risks that you pose. You know, what happens if you get locked up? What if you say something that's anti-government? And this sort of stuff is a panic for producers. And so I applaud the ABC for having the courage to do it. And I think that's been the reason why there's been delays.
Well, carry over the champ. It's been nice to go down that rabbit hole and revisit what was. I mean, I just remember how much I loved it, how much my mates loved it, and how groundbreaking it was. So I agree. You know, I applaud the ABC for trying to get this up and running again. Tony, good to speak with you. Carry on, champ.
There's no age limit stated on the application press release. You never know, I might have a crack.
You might be able to hold on to that trophy. You never know. Tony Wilson, the winner of Series 2 from Race Around the World back in 1998. So, yes, Race Around the World is actually calling for the next big filmmakers, content creators and storytellers from all around Australia. You basically, as Tony said, you just have to have the courage to produce a film every 10 days for 100 days across 10 different countries. Do you think you could do that? If you think you can go to racearoundtheworldcasting.com.au and apply. But what I found fascinating was Tony talking about it was his way out from his old job or from the job that he didn't like and how it pretty much just changed his life overnight. And that happens not just in Race Around the World. It happens in all different types of reality TV. If this has been you, 1-300-222-774. It was for Matt Hopcraft, who is an associate professor in professional practice at Melbourne Dental School. But you also might know him as former MasterChef contestant. You were on 10 years ago, but Matt, you were also on just recently on the series Back to Win. Were you like Tony in that you wanted a way out from dentistry and you wanted to make yourself and make your life as a chef, or was it just to be on telly?
It's a really good question, and I reflect on this a lot about the decision that I made. Part of it was looking for different opportunities, and then part of it was, you know, I had a close friend who recently died, and that was a bit life changing. I think to sort of think about, you know, life is really short, and what are the opportunities to go out and do some interesting things. And I'd always been, you know, in love with cooking and really loved that show. And I just thought, you know, why not throw my hat in the ring and see what comes of it. And so that's why I did it.
Was it life changing?
In a strange kind of way, yes. You know, I got a great appreciation for the industry, the food industry, and it made me realise that it probably wasn't really an area that I wanted to go into. But there's this really good intersection between healthy eating and oral health, and so it sort of, for me, really catapulted my ability to advocate in an oral health perspective, to the extent that, you know, you've now got me on speed dial, and whenever you want to talk about oral health,
yeah, I'll chat to you.
I will come on and talk about it. So in this really weird way, it's kind of helped me back in my own career rather than going down a food path, but talking about food, talking about healthy eating, you know, in a really positive and important way.
There's reality TV and there's reality TV. I mean, starting today's conversation, because Race Around the World is relaunching, it was the first almost. I mean, people are saying Sylvanian Waters, of course there's that, but in terms of this type of reality TV. But since then, Matt, oh my goodness, there's just, you can't turn the telly on without there being some type or some level of reality TV. What's it like watching yourself back on it, you know, in terms of how you're edited, the storyline that's told about you?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, and it's hard to watch yourself on TV and see how you look to other people, and so I try not to do that too much. I think we were really fortunate in MasterChef because it's really a show about the contestants cooking great food. And so for us, I don't think, and certainly for me, you know, I was really happy with the way that I was portrayed on TV. And, you know, there are other shows that, you know, perhaps take a slightly different approach to that, a slightly different angle to that. They also have a slightly different type of contestant too. But I think it's the unknown going in, you know, what will they do? How will they make me look? But you can only, I mean, my view on it was I can only ever look the way that I am, really. And if I do something stupid, I'll look stupid on TV.
So don't do anything stupid.
And of course, you know, I didn't ever live up to that. I did stupid things all of the time. But it was interesting just listening to Tony talk. You know, yeah. He was going to countries and, you know, they were confiscating his film. You know, there were serious risks. And for us, you know, yes, we had a few people chop off bits and pieces of their fingers and there was a lot of burns in hot ovens. But, the level of risk and the things that people do on these different shows is really quite wide and varied.
Can you watch reality TV, any other types of reality TV?
I can. And it's interesting now watching it through the lens of a contestant because I think you view it a little bit differently. You know, I watched the recent series of The Block. My wife is obsessed with sort of renovating shows, and so we watched that. And watching it through the lens of the contestants and the struggles that you have as a contestant on the show that aren't always obvious to people who are watching it. So I think you watch it slightly differently because you can. I have a lot more empathy for people on those shows.
Absolutely, once you've got an inside.
Some of it.
Well, next time we need to talk, it's anything dental or oral health will give you a buzz. Matt, thank you.
Always happy to. Have a great day.
Matt Hopcraft, Associate Professor in Professional Practice at Melbourne Dental School. Yes, he's also a former MasterChef contestant. He was on about 10 years ago, but it was also on the most recent season, Back to Win. And we've been talking about reality TV, why we watch it, would you go on it? This, I think they might take someone in their 40s, I hope so. It was my dream as a teenager, and I never did it back then, says this text. And we're talking about Race Around the World because they're calling for the latest filmmakers and content creators and storytellers. This, I loved watching Race Around the World. I still remember Tony Wilson's documentary on laughter clubs in India. It was funny and it was inspiring. So many great young filmmakers. That's from Phil. 1-300-222-774. Simon Taylor, TV writer, stand-up comedian. Simon, when you think reality TV, what do you think?
For me, I don't know, probably The Bachelor, really.
That's the ultimate trash, right?
Maps or Bachelor. I mean, I guess it's sort of that. Well, because I love Osher Ginsberg, so he's a mate of mine. So, I think it's interesting. Race Around the World doesn't feel like reality TV.
No, it doesn't. That's the thing.
It feels like... No, there's something a little more, anything like the Bake Off or things like that, or even, I mean, MasterChef is a little more sensationalized, but there's a wholesomeness to when it's about people creating something. And I would, you know, distinguish that from reality TV, which is usually just about, you know, people watching a lot of the time.
And that's the difference, I guess, with the types of reality TV. There are those like Tony, for example, Tony Wilson and Race Around the World trying to create something. And then those who go on it just to raise their own profile. There's nothing like switching around from reality TV show to reality TV show and realizing that one or two of the contestants have been on about five or six of them. So there's sort of just casting themselves far and wide. So the reason as to why someone goes on reality TV is very different.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's also a barrier to entry with this. I mean, it's what they will be casting is the ability for someone to craft a story with a camera. And it's not quite reality TV where you're casting people who are just, you know, as your last guest mentioned, willing to say something stupid on TV.
Yeah, or get their boobs out or whatever it may be.
Yes, or I think throwing wine is the prerequisite for a lot of... Are you willing to throw a glass of wine at someone on TV is the prerequisite for a lot of those dating shows. But I think this is at least craft-focused, and I think that's a positive.
There's a lot of excitement about Race Around the World and it coming back, but I found it fascinating listening to Tony around, okay, well, you know, what would the risks be now? Would they have to put a lot of red tape around it in terms of ensuring that people are safe, that they don't get thrown in jail, that they don't put their own lives at risk? And then on top of it, Simon, in the 30 years since Race Around the World, people are making their own content and creating their own films and documentaries and uploading it all the time. So
yes.
Is there a need for a show like this?
Well, that's my question, how they're going to do it differently. So I think, look, the safety thing is pretty pertinent now because, even America is being incredibly authoritarian about, you know, criticizing their government. And there are journalists who are being interviewed at immigration in America saying, do you criticize the government? There are comedians who are being asked, do you do political comedy? So I think the world in general feels a little more restrictive in some senses, in particular China as well is cracking down on social media and influencers. So that concern is pertinent. Mm. The second thing about, my question about the fact that there's a lot of user-generated content now. Everyone's a documentary filmmaker. So in 97, I just watched the 1997 finale, season one finale, and one of the documentaries was in a Buddhist monastery. And, you know, at the time, that would have been very fascinating to get that insight. But now, and I just looked it up, there's a monk who has a TikTok account.
Yeah.
So you can actually see right now, you can see live what's going on in the monastery. So the filmmakers have a challenge now of discovering a story that is untold, which just means they're going to be mining a bit deeper for gold than maybe they would have used to do.
Well, that is the line of the day. There is a monk with a TikTok account. So
that's
how
true.
Are you going
it's a good account.
To top that pretty much? And these are the challenges that the next round of those wanting to be a part of Race Around the World will have around them. Simon Taylor, question without notice. The social media ban is just around the corner. We know that teen magazines, you know, when you and I were growing up, we would have loved teenage magazines. They just don't survive anymore. Could they make a comeback, do you think? If those under the age of 16 can't access social media, could Dolly magazine, could Teen Vogue, could all of those mags have a place again, do you think?
I wonder. I do like the idea of, you know, old technology, old mediums coming back in general. I think that would be a positive thing. I mean, but then some of them were trash as well. I mean, it was just a very slow version of...
As opposed to TikTok.
It was just a slow version of sensationalism. So are we just slowing down the bad content or are we promoting good content? So I'm all about it. I mean, I would love to, you know, I was just thinking the other day, sometimes I ignore my son because I'm scrolling on my phone. You know, I should be ignoring him because I'm reading a magazine.
There's multiple ways to ignore your children.
Yes, exactly. So
good to speak with you as always, Simon. Thank you.
I hope it happens.
Simon Taylor, TV writer, stand-up comedian. He's got gigs coming up in Shepparton and Ballarat and Frankston over the next couple of months. You can go to simontaylorfunnyboy.com for details. So many of us reminiscing around Race Around the World and why we loved it. John Safran's application video to go and race around the world was brilliant, says Malcolm. So if you're up for it, applications are open. It's racearoundtheworldcasting.com.au. They are calling, the ABC is calling for that next round of filmmakers and content creators. Maybe it's you, and maybe like that previous text, maybe you wanted to do it back in the 90s. There is no age limit, so maybe this is still your chance. Up next, teen magazines. Could they come back?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So whenever we talk about magazines, especially in our teen years, we all still lament and get really sad about the idea of Dolly magazine just not being there, in particular Dolly Doctor and the role that Dolly played. But teen magazines, I mean, did you have one? How important were they? Yet another, Teen Vogue. It's no longer going to be a standalone magazine. It's not going away as such. It's merging into Vogue's general website. But given that just around the corner is the social media ban for teens under the age of 16, would your teenager in your household read a magazine? If teen magazines came back, would they now work given that the social media ban is just around the corner? 1300 222 774. Kirsty Clements, journalist, author, former editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia. Kirsty, I mean, Teen Vogue, it's not shutting down as such, but it will no longer be a standalone magazine. It's being merged into Vogue's general website. Is this kind of the last of teen mags that are biting the dust?
Yes, I would probably think so. I was surprised to hear that Teen Vogue was even still in a print format. I thought that it was online only. So that's the way most magazines are going, to actually be only digital and have the numbers there, as opposed to the print products tend to be lost leaders, is what they call them at the moment, where they're part of the group, you know, they're part of the whole facade of that title, but everything's happening online.
Given the social media ban is a month or so away, teen magazines online, could they have a resurgence? Could they? Is there a role for them in some way, because you would have some level of safety in check?
I think so. I mean, it's hard for us to predict if the generation that are digital natives will actually go to print. I mean, most of the teenagers and girls in their early 20s and boys as well, of my friends, none of them would think about picking up a print product. But particularly, we're talking about teens and being banned, potentially, but it has to be good content. Going back to you, to Simon, who was just saying, I don't think they need to go out and buy trash. It has to be actually really on-point, curated content like Dolly used to be way back in its heyday, you know, where it was really communicating directly with the consumer, you know, and not just being a cheap thing that got put out with the least amount of staff and the least amount of money.
Isn't it interesting that we still, I mean, Dolly shut down in 2016. You know, we still mourn Dolly magazine. I mean, we haven't stopped talking about it in 10 years.
No, and interestingly, I got a lot of emails from former readers of Vogue who are quite nostalgic for that period where there was obviously much more staff, there was much more stories from the ground up that were very relatable to the Australian market and to, you know, to Australian readers, and all that sort of stuff has become quite nostalgic now that it's all caught up in the vortex of global digital everything. Too much information. I think people are craving, I think a lot of it is too much information, and people craving the idea of an expert editor curating something for you and knowing what your target is and understanding the demographic and wanting to have a conversation with them directly rather than this scattergun approach that's tiring everybody out.
I just got this text. My teenage son thinks this is the most ridiculous thing he has ever heard and that you're out of the loop and magazines are for old people.
he's not right. I mean, honestly, if you do ask any of them, have you picked up a magazine, they don't even know what you're talking about, and they don't know the old titles. If you raise names like Harper's Bazaar and things like that, they, like, look at you blankly. So,
I mean, don't know what they're missing out on, though.
Kirsty,
there's nothing better than, it could be a fashion magazine, a house magazine, a gardening magazine, whatever it is, and sitting down on your own with a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or something, and you open that first page and you're sitting in a comfy chair and you know you've got the next half an hour, you know, hour just to yourself to look at things that you will never buy and that you can't afford, but you can dream.
Oh, couldn't agree more. I mean, that was the whole magic of them. But I think the what they call the shelter titles, which is the interior magazines and the gourmet food and travel, they're still really popular. They still have, you know, you'd call them niche publishing, but it's a big niche. But it's the, I think it was the more things like Dolly and fashion magazines that have kind of got caught up in the vortex of you know, once the consumer became in control of what they wanted to look at, then, you know, that was a necessary goodbye to that. But I think, yeah, they don't know what they're missing out on, but then often they'll do that with books, or they'll buy something like an art title or an indie magazine. You know, some of the independent titles and things have good readership and good strong readership because they find their niche and they communicate, you know, strongly to them.
And then there's what do you do with the magazines? Kirsty, just finally, let's not even go there, the twitch will start in my eye, but I'm moving house at the moment and I've all of my magazines. I love magazines, fashion, furniture, you name it. Yes. But then when you move house, you're like, oh, what do I do with all of these magazines? And then you start to do the maths on how much money have I spent on all of these magazines.
Yes, but they were moments of pure pleasure, I think, most of the time. So that's okay. You might have to do a Marie Kondo and just thank them for their service.
I thanked them for their service and I popped them in the recycling.
I don't know that. And then off they go. I think they have, the thing, they're so current and of the minute, that's their value. That's why they're lovely. So, but yeah, you might have to kiss them goodbye.
Thank you. Yeah, I did. Because I was just over it. I'm like, okay, you have to go into the recycling now. Kirsty, thank you. Kirsty Clements, journalist, author, former editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia. So Teen Vogue, no longer a standalone mag. Did you, even read it? As a teenager, did you read mags? And like this teenage son that sent a text to me saying, this is the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard, that I'm out of the loop, magazines are just for old people. Do you agree? Or maybe you've got a young person in your life who likes magazines. 1-300-222-774. We've also been talking at the beginning of the program, if you've just joined us, we were talking about in New York City, how as the race for the mayor is on at the moment, the elections, they're about to call who will be the latest New York City mayor. One of the ideas that's being floated around is government-run supermarkets. So what if that happened here? Not necessarily the government running a supermarket, but what if we found a way to take the profit out of supermarkets, that it became for people and not about money, whether it be a cooperative? Let's have a chat to Nigel. Hi, Nigel. What do you think of the idea, Nigel?
Yeah, I heard some of that earlier discussion, and I'm now ex-farmer and moving into those lovely, probably get called a boomer still, but I remember my parents who lived through wars and things like that. I just probably come at it from a point where as a society we actually undervalue food, where people want to prioritise the latest shoes or the holiday to Bali, but they always want to try and scrimp and scrape on food. And at some point, somebody's got to produce that food. Mm. If they don't get a return for it, it's just not going to be there.
There's room for a change in the system, do you think, Nigel, and how they're run?
I think living long enough, I've seen like the lots of the cooperative model, the great model, if it's run properly. It used to work really well for agriculture, and seen it in local communities around here. There's a local pub that's gone back to a cooperative thing, and I think it's a great model, but I think somewhere or other we can't just keep driving down the expectations of cheap food all the time.
Would you ever like to see a government run a supermarket here, Nigel? Would you trust them?
No, I think anything where the government gets involved, they just seem to find a way of red tape and making things not work. You know, again, through years in agriculture, I've seen everything the government gets involved turn to mush. So, yeah, I think the government needs to stay out of that. And it's the usual thing. Like, the government wants to run around and talk about free enterprise, but then, like, from a farming perspective, they won't let the farmers determine the price for their product. So that's where you start bringing in this lovely spiral of supermarkets screwing farmers or consumers or... it's like whenever the government gets
involved. Are you a farmer, Nigel?
Milk cows for 40 years. I'm not anymore now. Over the years, I've seen, you know, numerous struggles and been involved in different little protests and things like that. I'll admit I'm sort of probably biased a little bit to the agriculture side of things, but even as a society, I think, just our priorities get skewed on, you know, even between buying imported. You know, I can remember 10 years ago in this area up around Shepparton, there was the whole big thing about support FPC and Italian tomatoes. And now you've got to see, you know, see the ads on television for one of the major supermarkets promoting Italian tomatoes. It's,
Well, this is the thing that the Hunger Report, we spoke to Dave McNamara from Food Bank, and that was a lot of what the Hunger Report that's just been released addressed as well. Nigel, good to have a chat with you. Thank you. We've also been talking about whether or not teenagers would read magazines. We loved them as kids. Of course, we didn't have social media, but those under the age of 16 won't have social media in about 4 weeks' time. This, Rochelle, just in terms of your magazines, go to your local library. That's a great way to read. There's a good variety there. And others saying, Rich, think about what you're really buying with magazines. How much money have you lost on magazines in terms of reading mags and reaching out? That's from Susan. I didn't want to do the math when I looked at how many magazines I had and what I was going to do with them. But whether or not young people would read magazines, Rish, you need to understand that young people's brains don't work that way. The print medium is just not suitable for their thinking and their style in general. They process information differently. Each generation changes. But maybe that's the point with the social media ban. The idea of slowing down and reading a magazine is good for our teen brains. If you want to listen back to today's show, you always can. Don't forget the Conversation Hour every day is turned into a podcast. You can listen either through the ABC Listen app, just hit that little love heart next to Conversation Hour, or you can go to the ABC website as well and listen back to today. But I'll be back with you tomorrow. Till then, take care.